Chapter 2. Marina's affair with Demond Veen started on his, her, and Daniel Veen's birthday, January 5th, 1868, when she was 24 and both Veens 30. As an actress, she had none of the breathtaking quality that makes the skill of mimicry seem, at least while the show lasts, worth even more than the price of such footlights as insomnia, fancy, arrogant art. Yet on that particular night, with soft snow falling beyond the plush and the paint, La Durmanska, who paid the great Scott, her impresario, 7,000 gold dollars a week for publicity alone, plus a bonny bonus for every engagement, had been from the start of the trashy ephemeron, an American play based by some pretentious hack on a famous Russian romance, so dreamy, so lovely, so stirring, that Demond, not quite a gentleman in amorous matters, made a bet with his orchestra seat neighbor, Prince N, bribed a series of green room attendants, and then, in a cabinet reculé, as a French writer of an earlier century might have mysteriously called that little room in which the broken trumpet and poodle hoops of a forgotten clown, besides many dusty pots of colored grease, happened to be stored, proceeded to possess her between two scenes, chapter 3 and 4 of the martyred novel. In the first of these, she had undressed in graceful silhouette behind a semi-transparent screen, reappeared in a flimsy and fetching nightgown, and spent the rest of the wretched scene discussing a local squire, Baron Doe, with an old nurse in Eskimo boots. Upon the infinitely wise countrywoman's suggestion, she goose-penned from the edge of her bed on a side table with cabriole legs a love letter, and took 5 minutes to reread it in a languorous but loud voice for nobody's benefit in particular, since the nurse sat dozing on a kind of sea chest, and the spectators were mainly concerned with the artificial moonlight's blaze upon the lovelorn young lady's bare arms and heaving breasts. Even before the old Eskimo had shuffled off with the message, Demond Veen had left his pink velvet chair and proceeded to win the wager, the success of his enterprise being assured by the fact that Marina, a kissing virgin, had been in love with him since their last dance on New Year's Eve. Moreover, the tropical moonlight she had just bathed in, the penetrative sense of her own beauty, the ardent pulses of the imagined maiden, and the gallant applause of an almost full house made her especially vulnerable to the tickle of Demond's mustache. She had ample time, too, to change for the next scene, which started with a longish intermezzo staged by a ballet company, whose services Scotty had engaged, bringing the Russians all the way in two sleeping cars from Belokhansk, west Estoti. In a splendid orchard, several merry young gardeners, wearing for some reason the garb of Georgian tribesmen, were popping raspberries into their mouths, while several equally implausible servant girls in charovars. Somebody had goofed, the word samovars may have got garbled in the agent's aero cable, were busy plucking marshmallows and peanuts from the branches of fruit trees. At an invisible sign of Dionysian origin, they all plunged into the violent dance called curva, or ribbon boule, in the hilarious program whose howlers almost caused Veen, tingling and light-loined and with Prince N's rose-red banknote in his pocket, to fall from his seat. His heart missed a beat and never regretted the lovely loss as she ran, flushed and flustered, in a pink dress into the orchard, earning a clack third of the sitting ovation that greeted the instant dispersal of the imbecile but colorful transfigurants from Liaska or Iveria. Her meeting with Baron O, who strolled out of a side alley, all spurs and green tails, somehow eluded Demond's consciousness. So struck was he by the wonder of that brief abyss of absolute reality between two bogus fulgurations of fabricated life. Without waiting for the end of the scene, he hurried out of the theater into the crisp, crystal night, the snowflakes star-spangling his top hat as he returned to his house in the next block to arrange a magnificent supper. By the time he went to fetch his new mistress in his jingling sleigh, The last act ballet of Caucasian generals and metamorphosed Cinderellas had come to a sudden close, and Baron Doe, now in black tails and white gloves, was kneeling in the middle of an empty stage, holding the glass slipper that his fickle lady had left him when eluding his belated advances. The claqueurs were getting tired and looking at their watches when Marina, in a black cloak, slipped into Demond's arms and Swan's sleigh. They reveled and traveled, and they quarreled and flew back to each other again. By the following winter, he began to suspect she was being unfaithful to him, but could not determine his rival. In mid-March, at a business meal with an art expert, an easygoing, lanky, likable fellow in an old-fashioned dress coat, Demond screwed in his monocle, unclicked out of its special flat case, a small pen and wash, and said that he thought, did not doubt, in fact, but wished his certitude to be admired, that it was an unknown product of Parmigianino's tender art. It showed a naked girl with a peach-like apple cupped in her half-raised hand, sitting sideways on a convolvulus garlanded support, and had for its discoverer the additional appeal of recalling Marina when, wrung out of a hotel bathroom by the phone and perched on the arm of a chair, she muffled the receiver while asking her lover something that he could not make out because the bath's voice drowned her whisper. Baron Donsky had only to cast one glance at that raised shoulder and at certain vermiculated effects of delicate vegetation to confirm Demond's guess. Donosky had the reputation of not showing one sign of aesthetic emotion in the presence of the loveliest masterpiece. This time, nonetheless, he laid his magnifier aside as he would a mask and allowed his undisguised gaze to caress the velvety apple and the nude's dimpled and mossed parts with a smile of bemused pleasure. Would Mr. Veen consider selling it to him there and then, Mr. Veen, please? Mr. Veen would not. Skanky, a one-way nickname, must content himself with the proud thought that, as of today, he and the lucky owner were the sole people to have ever admired it en connaissance de cause. Back it went into its special integument, but after finishing his fourth cup of cognac, Doe pleaded for one last peep. Both men were a little drunk, and Demond secretly wondered if the rather banal resemblance of that Edenic girl to a young actress, whom his visitor had no doubt seen on the stage in Eugene and Lara, or Lenore Raven, both painfully panned by a disgustingly incorruptible young critic, should be or would be commented upon. It was not. Such nymphs were really very much alike because of their elemental limpidity, since the similarities of young bodies of water are but murmurs of natural innocence and double-talk mirrors. That's my hat. His is older, but we have the same London hatter. Next day, Demond was having tea at his favorite hotel with a Bohemian lady whom he had never seen before and was never to see again. She desired his recommendation for a job in the glass, fish, and flower department in a Boston museum, when she interrupted her voluble self to indicate Marina and Aqua blankly slinking across the hall in modish sullenness and bluish furs with Dan Veen and a dackle behind, and said, "Curious how that appalling actress resembles Eve on the clepsydrophone in Parmigianino's famous picture."
"It is anything but famous," said Demond quietly,
"and you can't have seen it." "I don't envy you," he added, "the naive stranger who realizes that he or she has stepped into the mud of an alien life must experience a pretty sickening feeling. Did you get that small talk information directly from a fellow named Donsky, or through a friend of a friend of his?"
"Friend of his," replied the hapless Bohemian lady.
Upon being questioned in Demond's dungeon, Marina, laughingly, trillingly, wove a picturesque tissue of lies, then broke down and confessed. She swore that all was over, that the Baron, a physical wreck and a spiritual samurai, had gone to Japan forever,
From a more reliable source, Daman learned that the samurai's real destination was smart little Vatican, a Roman spa, whence he was to return to Aardvark Masa in a week or so. Since prudent Veen preferred killing his man in Europe, decrepit but indestructible Gamaliel was said to be doing his best to forbid duels in the Western Hemisphere. A canard or an idealistic president's instant coffee caprice, for nothing was to come of it after all. Daman rented the fastest petrol plane available, overtook the Baron, looking very fit, in Nice, saw him enter Gunter's bookshop, went in after him, and in the presence of the imperturbable and rather bored English shopkeeper, backslapped the astonished Baron across the face with a lavender glove. The challenge was accepted. Two native seconds were chosen, the Baron plumped for swords, and after a certain amount of good blood, Polish and Irish, a kind of American Gory Mary in barroom parlance, had bespattered two hairy torsos, the whitewashed terrace, the flight of steps leading backward to the walled garden in an amusing Douglas D'Artagnan arrangement, the apron of a quite accidental milkmaid, and the shirt sleeves of both seconds, charming Monsieur de Pastruil and Colonel Saint-Alain, a scoundrel. The latter gentleman separated the panting combatants, and Skanky died. Not of his wounds, as was viciously rumored, but of a gangrenous afterthought on the part of the least of them, possibly self-inflicted, a sting in the groin which caused circulatory trouble, notwithstanding quite a few surgical interventions during 2 or 3 years of protracted stays at the Aardvark Hospital in Boston, a city where, incidentally, he married in 1869 our friend the Bohemian lady, now keeper of Glass Biota at the local museum. Marina arrived in Nice a few days after the duel and tracked Daman down in his Villa Armina, and in the ecstasy of reconciliation neither remembered to dupe procreation, whereupon started the extremely interesnoye polezhnie, interesting condition, without which, in fact, these anguished notes could not have been strung.
Van, I trust your taste and your talent, but are we quite sure we should keep reverting so zestfully to that wicked world which, after all, may have existed only onirologically, Van?
Marginal jotting in Ada's 1965 hand, crossed out lightly in her latest wavering one. That reckless stage was not the last but the shortest, a matter of 4 or 5 days. He pardoned her. He adored her. He wished to marry her very much, on the condition she dropped her theatrical career at once. He denounced the mediocrity of her gift and the vulgarity of her entourage, and she yelled he was a brute and a fiend. By April 10th, it was Aqua who was nursing him, while Marina had flown back to her rehearsals of Lucille, yet another execrable drama heading for yet another flop at the Lador Playhouse. Adieu. Perhaps it is better thus, wrote Daman to Marina in mid-April 1869. The letter may be either a copy in his calligraphic hand or the unposted original. For whatever bliss might have attended our married life, and however long that blissful life might have lasted, one image I shall not forget and will not forgive. Let it sink in, my dear. Let me repeat it in such terms as a stage performer can appreciate. You had gone to Boston to see an old aunt, a cliché, but the truth for the nonce, and I had gone to my aunt's ranch near Lolita, Texas. Early one February morning, around noon chez vous, I rang you up at your hotel from a roadside booth of pure crystal, still tear-stained after a tremendous thunderstorm, to ask you to fly over at once, because I, Daman, rattling my crumpled wings and cursing the automatic Doraphone, could not live without you, and because I wished you to see, with me holding you, the days of desert flowers that the rain had brought out. Your voice was remote but sweet. You said you were in Eve's state. Hold the line. Let me put on a peignoir. Instead, blocking my ear, you spoke, I suppose, to the man with whom you had spent the night. and whom I would have dispatched had I not been overeager to castrate him. Now that is the sketch made by a young artist in Parma in the 16th century for the fresco of our destiny, in a prophetic trance, and coinciding, except for the apple of terrible knowledge, with an image repeated in two men's minds. Your runaway maid, by the way, has been found by the police in a brothel here, and will be shipped to you as soon as she is sufficiently stuffed with mercury.